From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A prominent American news anchor on Iranian state television has been reportedly arrested by the FBI during a visit to the U.S. this week. That, according to Press TV, the news agency which employs her. Marzia Hashemi, who anchors for Press TV, was detained in St. Louis, where she had been filming a Black Lives Matter documentary after visiting relatives in the New Orleans area. She was taken to Washington, D.C., according to her oldest son, Hossein Hashemi. This is what he told Press TV Wednesday.
Currently, the information that is available to us is that she is being detained as a material witness. There aren't any charges against her. The officials have let us know that much in regard to her case. However, she is being detained in a Washington, D.C. facility. It is a prison system. She has an inmate number, and she's being held in a cell. So, you know, we've been just very curious as to how someone who does not have any charges against them can be held in those circumstances. We were able to speak with her. My sister spoke with her last night. This is over 48 hours since she was detained, since she was apprehended, that we made contact with her. Up until that time, we had very little information, even about the fact that there were no charges and so forth. She seemed okay. She was upset about the kind of treatment that she was receiving as a person who has charges against him would be treated. She had only eaten pretzels because her dietary restrictions limited her from the kinds of food that the prison facility was offering. She was also upset about the fact that her hijab was removed during processing, and later on she was only able to cover her head with a t-shirt, apparently. So these are the issues that she was upset about. I think, you know, from our perspective, obviously we want more clear answers. The fact that she hasn't been charged has made it difficult for us to know what kind of lawyers to pursue and what route forward we should go with, because lawyers have particular specialties, and the fact that she hasn't been charged makes it difficult. And it's also, we have a hard time understanding how someone who is not charged can be held in a facility like that. I think it's important to note that, she is an American citizen. She is a journalist. She's somebody who does documentaries on Black Lives Matters and is critical of a lot of the domestic policies of the United States government, the school to prison sort of pipeline in the Black community, and also the wars abroad and the regime change policies that the United States enforces all the time and puts major budgets behind. She is critical of all these things. So that is, I think, all plays into it. We don't know whether those are the reasons for her apprehension, but it's difficult to not become sort of conspiratorial about what is going on with, a person as high profile as my mother.
One theory referenced by the Associated Press is that she's being held in order to be traded for at least six Americans that are being held in Iran, whose names were listed in the Associated Press report, some of them on espionage charges. However, even if there is a trade, the FBI may be positioning itself for another round.
Additionally, I and my siblings have also received subpoenas to appear before a grand jury in Washington, D.C. So that is also concerning. We don't know what this is about yet, but we're trying to work it out. And, you know, the main request we have is information and to let us know what it is that she is being held for precisely, and that will help us proceed in the correct way, hopefully.
The younger Hashemi said that his mother comes back to the United States about once a year to visit family and usually schedules documentary work somewhere in the U.S. as well. According to the latest reports, she's being held as a material witness. The constitutionality of that law has never been meaningfully tested, according to Ricardo Bausquez, who, according to this report in the Associated Press, is a professor at the University of Miami School of Law. Bausquez reportedly said that, quote, the government only relies on it when they need a reason to arrest somebody, but they don't have one, closed quote. Meanwhile, the fury over Russiagate continues unabated. Black Agenda reports Glenn Ford caught up with Professor Stephen Cohen of NYU, one of the most knowledgeable Americans on matters pertaining to Russia and U.S. policy. That report comes to us from Nellie Bailey, who's co-host of Black Agenda Radio.
The Democrats seem certain to step up their investigations of the Trump administration now that they are a majority in the U.S. House. That also likely means more frenzy efforts to link Russia to the Trump presidential campaign. Stephen Cohen is the nation's best known expert on Russia, having studied that nation's politics in both the Soviet era and after Russia became capitalist. Cohen spoke with Black Agenda Report executive editor Glenn Ford, who remembers the tail end of anti-Russian hysteria during the McCarthy era. But Ford cannot recall anything during the McCarthy era that was as manic, loud, and relentless as today's hysteria against Russia. Professor Cohen agrees.
I, too, remember the end of McCarthyism. I, too, have never seen anything like this. In my new book, War with Russia with a Question Mark, I spend a good deal of time saying just that. I also say, though this may be a bit of an exaggeration, that when I lived in the Soviet Union as a scholar, before Gorbachev came to power and ended the censorship, that would have been in 1985-86, I recall vividly things like this happening in the Soviet Union. That is to say, people falling under suspicion for their, quote, contacts with Russia, for saying things that don't fit the mainstream orthodoxy. So I'm very alarmed by this. And this is quite apart from my dislike for Trump. But one of the points I make in the book is that the peril of this new Cold War is especially great because even when Trump does something sensible on behalf of our national security with Russia, it's called treason. So where does that leave the rest of us who have devoted much of our lives to contacts with Russia, scholarly, political, cultural, and who think that Americans need now, above all, but as we did during the old Cold War, to reach out to all the Russians we know, to bring Russians and Americans together, that's now fallen under suspicion. So it's a dangerous time, and you're absolutely right.
And we hear comments that actually have no place in civil discourse, like a high intelligence official, Clapper, talking about treachery and dishonesty being part of the DNA of the Russians.
And yet, Glenn, when he said that, and it was widely broadcast and printed, I think he said it on a Sunday morning news show, network news show, that Russians were genetically disposed to infiltrate Americans. And John Brennan, the former head of the CIA, said exactly the same thing. There was no protest in the mainstream media, even though it's a form of racism. When you attribute some predisposition to an ethnic group, it's disapproved of normally. If you said it about Jews or black folks or Italians or anybody, there'd be an uproar. But when these two very powerful former heads of our primary intelligence agencies made these remarks about Russia, the Russians passed almost unnoticed, though I treat it in the book. I was shocked that there was no protest. But something's happened here. It's a combination, I think, though I can't fully explain it, of intense dislike for Russia's leader since 2000, Vladimir Putin, and this intense loathing for Trump. And it's created a toxicity that's generated, as you say, a new McCarthyism. They're also doing things now, such as keeping people with dissenting views off radio and television programs where once they were welcomed. So this is a kind of censorship unfolding. And this is aside from the federal prosecutions that are going on. I mean, I personally don't think the Mueller investigation should have ever been established. But what we have at the moment are a bunch of convictions and pleas involving financial corruption that have nothing to do with Russia at all. So it's spreading, as it did under McCarthy. And unless the people who used to fight McCarthyism, that's liberals and progressives, stand up and say stop, I don't see where it's going to end.
You know, that Russian outfit in St. Petersburg that the Mueller folks indicted for meddling of some kind in U.S. politics doesn't look to me like a professional intelligence operation at all. What about you?
Well, let's context this a bit. So people, and I've been widely denounced for protesting this Russiagate stuff, say, well, Cohen, don't you think the Russians meddled in the 2016 presidential elections? And I said, sure they did. And so what? Because the United States has been meddling in Russian politics since the Russian Revolution. People forget we intervened in their civil war. My uncle actually was sent to Russia. I remember him telling me vividly the stories. We virtually got President Yeltsin of Russia reelected in 1996. Everybody knows that story. But we meddle. And they meddle in our elections. The old Communist Party was busy here. And nobody thought much about it. It's just something the two countries have done forever. And the only difference in 2016 was the advent of social media. So people who have looked at this social media, and remember that this began as saying the Russians had meddled. Okay. But now they're saying the Russians put Trump in the White House. This is something completely different. But serious people who have studied this, like Aaron Mate of The Nation, don't see that Russian social media added up to much of anything. And you know this guy, Nate Silvers, who's used to work for the Times and is considered the number one electoral pollster in the United States. He's a kind of guru. He said the other day that if there were 100 factors that got Trump elected in 2016, Russian social media wouldn't make the list of 100. And yet, we have the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Yorker magazine, Politico, saying that the Russians put Trump in the White House. So this is unprecedented, I think, in modern American history. Even Nixon, during Watergate, was never accused of being a foreign agent. So I come back to my point. Trump occasionally meets with Putin and he says, you know, we've got to rein in the new nuclear arms race, because there really is a new nuclear arms race. And we got to be careful we don't shoot each other down when we're flying over Syria. It could lead to war. Putin says, right, let's take steps to be careful. Trump comes home and it's called treason. Treason. So the danger is great. What worries me is I think, and I know in some cases, that there are people in Congress and in the mainstream media who agree, but they won't speak out.
For fear of?
I don't know. Is your memory of the late McCarthy period, does it include people whose lives were badly damaged by false accusations and suspicions? I remember a few. I remember my main professor at Columbia. I grew up in Kentucky, but I came to Columbia to get my PhD. A great man, Professor John Hazard, had been called by McCarthy simply because John had been deputy director of Lend-Lease during World War II. You remember Lend-Lease gave the Soviet Army material to fight the Nazis. and we sent them Studebakers and food and Spam. And yet he was called by McCarthy saying he had somehow been a Russian agent. John had a horrible time. He survived it, but it affected his life for years to come. So people have a genetic, we Americans have a genetic memory of what happened. Plus, I don't think, leaving aside, I guess, the civil rights struggle and a few other examples, maybe Vietnam, we don't have a very high tradition of civic courage among people in power or positions of authority in this country. We think we're a fiercely independent, free-speaking people, but compared to some nations, not so much, I think.
One of the bizarre aspects of Russiagate is that in their frenzy to charge that the Russians have done such huge harm to fragile U.S. institutions, these folks have actually themselves inflicted harm on the legitimacy of U.S. institutions, including the presidency, but also the U.S. electoral apparatus.
Well, I mean, I couldn't agree more, and it continues. It's another argument I make in this book, War with Russia, that in this insistence that the Russians, quote, attacked us in 2016, and there was no attack, but the New York Times refers to it as a digital Pearl Harbor. Imagine that, Glenn, a digital Pearl Harbor. I mean, we've been attacked twice, right? Pearl Harbor, I barely remember it. I was barely born. And again, I guess on 9/11, those were real attacks. Nothing like that happened in 2016. But when we say we were attacked by Russia during the election of 2016, imagine how dangerous it is. It implies that we're in a state of war with Russia, the other nuclear superpower, and that we should react accordingly. So you're getting this incredible warmongering that's going on now. And it's alarming that it's coming from liberal progressive circles, if not above all, at least equally. And so you have to wonder, those of us who have supported liberal progressive agendas, what this means for those agendas moving ahead. I mean, Nancy Pelosi said the other day, when she had been reelected speaker, that she found Trump's relations with Putin appalling. Now, every American president in my lifetime, since Eisenhower, has been empowered to deal with the Kremlin leader to avoid nuclear war. She is saying Trump should have no relations with the president of Russia. Where does that leave us? By the way, and your point about institutions is a very good one. If the Trump presidency is illegitimate, and that's what, you know, people in the New York Times, for example, I cite the Times only because it's the most influential paper in America, say that Trump's presidency is illegitimate and the elections that put him there are illegitimate, as you say. It casts suspicion on two pillars of American democracy, the presidency and elections. And it can't stop just with Trump now. I mean, you have losing candidates in local elections literally saying that they lost because of the Russians. I mean, there's no evidence that the Russians even knew they were candidates, but this is becoming an excuse for losing.
And this is a great irony. Here we have critics, largely from the Democratic Party, who complain about an imperial presidency, a presidency that wages war and moves troops around without consulting Congress, acts as if Congress doesn't exist, an imperial presidency, except when it comes to Russia, and then even the president can do nothing, not even shake a hand.
Well, that's it, isn't it? Exactly. And by the way, for what it's worth, we never ask what is the impact of these Russiagate allegations on Russia itself. A lot. I've been traveling to Russia for decades. I know a lot of Russians. I know Russians who like America, Russians who don't like America. I know Russians who are very happy with Putin. I know Russians who are unhappy with Putin. Russians are a diverse people politically. But the impact of these allegations that are now orthodox in America about Russia's role in our election in 2016 are badly damaging Russian Democrats. because they have argued for a long time that Russia needs to have more of the kind of democracy that America has. But now, if the official story is that Russia subverted our democracy and that Trump is illegitimate and elections are illegitimate, where does that leave those people in Russia who complain about Russian elections? Because people say, well, they do the same thing in America. And you love America, so who cares if Putin's election, re-election to the presidency, wasn't entirely kosher? It's better than it was in America, at least. I mean, I heard this. I was there in November. And I hear this line of discussion. I don't know what people in Europe think of us, but obviously we're becoming the subject of scorn around the world, and these are fictions. I mean, it isn't true.
U.S. media and U.S. politicians routinely call Vladimir Putin a dictator, although they do have elections in Russia. There are different parties. The second biggest party is the Communist Party, and there is polling in Russia, polling done by Russian and Western pollsters, which shows Putin is, well, phenomenally popular.
So we come here to what, for me, a long-time student historian of Russian politics, a complicated question. I begin my new book, War with Russia, with a long essay that's offended a lot of people. It's called Who Putin Is Not. And I look at each of the allegations against Putin, and I say they just aren't true. For example, the allegation that he's ordered the assassination of his political enemies. There's no evidence for that. The question of Putin's authentic popularity in Russia is more complicated. There is no question, anecdotally, and as you say, Russians have become obsessed with polling. They poll all the time, survey opinion. That even though there is growing discontent with Putin in Russia, mainly involving breadbasket issues, inflation, price of consumer goods and the rest, he has a bedrock immense popularity because most people believe he saved Russia when he came to power in 2000, remembering that Russia was in agony for the decade after the end of the Soviet Union. I mean, men were dying on average at 56. People weren't receiving their pensions. Unemployment, disemployment. The economy had become bartering what you had inherited from your parents or your grandparents. Russia was in danger of complete collapse. And above all, the people were in misery. And Putin and the people he brought around him turned that around. He was helped by high oil prices and all the rest, but they didn't steal that money. They put it back into the people. So Russia has begun to prosper under Putin during 20 years. And this is all reflected in statistics and polls. So is Putin a dictator? Well, everything's relative, right, Glenn? I mean, we look around our own lives and we say, how are things? And we say to ourselves, compared to what? Are they better or worse for us or people we care about than they were 20 years ago or 10 years ago? That's the key question in any country. And in Russia, whether we like Putin or not, the Russian people generally are so much better off today after 20 years of Putin's rule than they were before Putin, choose any era you want, that political support means that the numbers he gets when he runs for re-election, close to 65% to 70%, are confirmed by pollsters. That's basically his support. Now, it ebbs and flows. It's been as high as 80. It's dropped down to 60. That's normal. But imagine a politician who's been in office 20 years and retains his bedrock support. That's pretty remarkable. And it has a lot to do with Putin, but a lot to do for Russians with what came before him. So it's contemptuous and it's arrogant for Americans to criticize Putin if the majority of Russian people believe that he's been a kind of savior leader. Now, future historians will judge him for both his pluses and his minuses. And I try to do that in my new book. I say, here, I think, are the pluses. Here are the minuses. But we need some perspective. And all of this demonizing of Putin becomes part of this new Cold War. I mean, I ask myself, and I can't fully explain it, why was it okay for every president of my lifetime since Eisenhower to deal with the leader of the Kremlin, who were Soviet communists? Putin's an anti-communist, he's a capitalist, he says. Deal with them regularly without it being called treason, and yet when an American president talks about arms control or nuclear proliferation or terrorists in Syria with the Kremlin leader, it's called treason. Something's happened, and it has more to do with us than what's happened in Russia.
And finally, you'd think that the United States would be trying everything in its power to keep Russia and China apart. But it's been clear that U.S. policy has driven these two countries into what is now a strong strategic alliance.
That is certainly true, though I would dissent a bit from the way you set up the question, that we should do everything possible to keep Russia and China apart. My reaction to that is twofold. The old world order, which we sought to dominate, the United States did, and did so successfully for decades, is crumbling before our eyes, whether we look at the East and the rise of China, or we look at the crisis of the European Union and Brexit, or we look at our own country. Trump's He's not an isolationist, but he's not an interventionist. All these symptoms are signs of a world changing. One of the changes will be, for obvious reasons, that they are neighbors, they are natural trading partners, and they are both threatened by NATO, that Russia and China are going to grow closer and closer together. If this means economic prosperity for both and not a military threat, I'm all for it. I mean, there's no reason why they shouldn't be prospering trade partners. It's a perfect fit. They have what the other needs, goods and markets and investment. But, as you say, our policy is turning them into military strategic allies because we threaten both of them. And that's the mistake. I would like a president that not only blesses Russia, Chinese, economic, cultural affinities, but participates in it and says the United States wants to join you. It'll create jobs in America. But turning Russia and China, as our Pentagon has done in recent years, even beginning under Obama, as our two main enemies, when neither actually threatens us, is a grievous mistake. So I agree with you with the outcome, but I don't think there's any reason why we should worry about Russia and China. You know, it's interesting. Putin wants to create this so-called European-Asian Economic Union, modeled on the European Union. Why is it okay for European countries to gather together to create a vast market, but it's not okay for Russia and China to do the same thing in the East? I mean, if we're all capitalists, to the extent that we profess to be, this is international global capitalism. If what's good for Europe and the United States, why wouldn't it be good for Russia and China if we care about people?
That's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.